hospitals. The state, although ANILCA says up to $5 million are to be available, Congress has never appropriated more than $1 million. And that's a reimbursable amount. The state has to spend $2 million to get $1 million. We're currently spending about $4 million on this in this area between the boards and the Division of Subsistence. And the state does get reimbursed $1 million. Your third question, I'm not familiar with the regulations for deer hunting and salmon, silver salmon in Southeastern. But my understanding is that the deer regulations, maybe I better just leave it at that. But my typically in those kinds of situations, unless the board of game tries to accommodate customer traditional uses through its normal seasons and bag limits. And in Southeastern, my understanding is in many areas the deer seasons and bag limits are fairly liberal. There's fairly long seasons in some areas, but that's quite variable. I'm not familiar with the silver salmon situation. I could certainly get that information for you.
Steve?
I just want to make a couple of comments about the situation because they point up some of the dilemmas in the currently operating subsistence law. I don't think we want to go into them at great length right now. This is a community, a heterogeneous community with a population of, Nelson mentioned, 2,000, Tlingit, I presume those are all the tribes, and Haida, okay, Woodrow. And the entire population of the community of Sitka is 8,000. It's in this kind of a community in which the application of the state standard on a community level may lead to the denial of subsistence access to these kinds of populations. In this particular case, we will see, I think, as the tribe in Sitka comes forward with a proposal to the subsistence division and the regulatory process about the coho season, about the deer season, we will see in the mechanisms of the data collection and the working out how that subsistence priority is going to be actualized in this particular case. It remains to be seen. It's an open question here when those things begin to come forward.
Sid Smith.
I was listening here yesterday, and what I wanted to do, I think there's a lot of new faces here. 10 years ago, I was sitting on the other side. My concerns were that the Alaska Lands Claim Act didn't address our way of life, which is an economic system. I hear that going back and forth, and that's what I felt in 74. I wrote 3 or 4 articles in Alaska Magazine, also Anchorage Times, and also the one in Dillingham. I approached AFN in 1974 to form a committee on subsistence, also justice. They funded us for 2 months, and then they defunded us. It upset me. But what I found out was that I upset them, because they were concerned about the D2, their land selections. It upset the state, and they were wondering why I was doing this. Finding out that AFN is basically funded by our regional corporations, I could understand that. So finally, after knocking on doors, the regional office for development, they won't listen to me. So I finally went into RULCAP. And we started the subsistence law. It took us approximately 4.5 years to get the bill passed. What happened in D.C., what Harold Spark was talking about, strategy. We talked about land use. You'll find out that at that time there was approximately 400,000 people in Alaska, approximately 75,000 Alaskan natives within the state. But by using the word majority, we talked about land use. Alaska Natives were the majority users of the state. We talked about all Alaskans in our writings. We didn't just talk about Natives, black, white. We talked about all Alaskans, all 400,000. We used those kind of words. Also, if you'll take notice, you're talking about who's managing the resources, the strategy we used, with all the follow-ups that the state has done. I can talk about this thing probably for 6 months, all the follow-ups that they had, from beaver, herring, you name it. We started realizing that our renewable resources were going to profit entities, big population coming in. We talked that we would like the state to manage the subsistence bill if it was passed, even though we knew of all the things that the state has done to us. When we got into the question, why did we want the state to manage our resources? We explained that is what we're looking at is what you call local control. It is very hard for the federal government to manage something way down in DC, just as it is to manage from Juneau. But at least it was closer home. We had a show and tell game. 1975, we decentralized the school system from Anchorage here. We used that approach, that we decentralize fish and game so we come more local control. We talked about the fish and game biologists as being horses with blinds on. Why? Because they didn't even understand the ecosystem. Why? I don't know. I'm not a biologist. But the thing about it is our people used to talk. Herring, king salmon live together. That's part of the ecosystem. Walrus, clams. Look at Walrus Island. There's no more clams left. What's happening? Walrus are going down to Port Moeller, coming into Nooshigak Bay. You never seen that before. When you talk about economic systems, if you go around the state, you will find out most of those people, if they make $4,000, how do they live when their cost is so high? A town or a city, average pay is $25,000. Think about it. How do they exist? I'll try to explain it later on. Where I come from, we have 240 people in the village. It's my third year in Anchorage. And it's getting to bother me a lot, but not as much because I work with a lot of young students. In that village, we only have 9 workers. That's what you call economic base. A lot of us are forgetting that. When we talk about villages, we talk in general terms what we know. The gentleman that lived in Lower 48 in Anchorage, he doesn't talk in terms of where's the economic base. We're forgetting those. There was a statement made yesterday about the state not concerned about the subsistence law in 1978. I happened to be there. The state wasn't even ready for it. They didn't know what the heck was going on. Skoog had to call the governor and get an attorney to say, hey, these guys are doing something out here. We've got to get on the ball. The state itself has a problem. 28% of the state is owned by the state of Alaska. 60% is owned by the federal government. The 11% that is owned by regional corporations and village corporations are pretty well and much in control if you really look at it. The land selections, majority of it was selected by subsistence way of life. They chose the land that they know that they can hunt on, but yet they still have minerals on. 1% is owned by private ownership. What's going to happen when a regional corporation makes decisions to get oil, timber, whatever? You think they're going to listen to their own people? Boy, you got something coming. They're basically forced by the federal government and the state to live up to their regime, which means profit-orientated. Another problem we got to look at. If you take a look at Hawaii, I happen to have a chance to talk to some of the people over in Hawaii. They're 4 to 5 generations behind. They don't talk about their culture. They don't look at it. They don't have potlatches. Alaska here, the Alaskan people here have it. They still have it. You can go out there and touch and look at it. And I think that's what a lot of the people are trying to preserve. When you talk about local advisory committees, that is one of our most scary things that you can ever work with. We looked at them. We found out that 60% of them was made up from the big, what we call urban villages like Dillingham, Bethel. And there were a lot of the people were guides, businessmen. The local people, like Bristol Bay has 29 villages. Out of the whole board member of 11, only one native from a village, which happened to be from Manukuduk. So the odds were against us there. When we were also in D.C., we did not want to upset the apple cart. Our goal behind the thing is what you call regulatory powers within a geographical area. That's what we're looking at. And that's what I hope we were talking about today. Take a look at it. Fish and Game, or the state of Alaska, doesn't want to hear that. That's a no-no. They say, how can you manage your resources? Do you have a degree? Things I'd like to talk about is like the first one, the regulatory powers within a geographical area. Also make it cost effective. We pounded on the state's door saying that we talked about 12 to 15. You know what they gave us? They gave us 6. So the people from Barrow to Bethel have to meet. How is that cost effective? Language. I hear the gentleman over here talking about money being spent by the state and being reimbursed by the federal government. We tried something we tried things to find out what's happening to what we're saying. So what we've done is when the state brought in their own secretaries and you name it, we said, no, we don't want them around here. Because every time we give you information, it is turned around. So what we did was we made a comparison of a local secretary from the village and show them the comparison, what's put down. And I realize that the state has to live by its guidelines, but they're not hearing what we're really saying. So that's one thing you have to watch for is the language. Is it really coming from the people that utilize these resources? Number three, one thing that you got to keep in mind, the 1971 Act is totally different from the 1978 Act. They're two separate acts, yet they kind of commingle. The other big problem that I see is that you're going to have to understand that we're dealing with two different types of economic systems. One is cash economy, one is subsistence economy. They are saying to our economy, which has existed for at least 40,000 years, change overnight. And that's exactly what they're trying to do, speed us up, speed us up. What I look at it is myself, and I wrote it, a story about why is the subsistence people a germ? Why are we a germ? Most of you people know what you do with a germ. You got the federal government, you've got the state, you've got the regional corporations, you've got PHS, you've got housing. They're attacking our way of life. There's so many problems to deal with it. But understand that there's two different systems. The cash economy only lasted for a little over 100 years. And you're saying that 100 years is better than 40,000? Those are the things you have to look at. I know it's going to be tough to say, well, let's take a look at it. And can't we have two different economic systems within the state? The thing I talked about earlier was that I feel that the Western culture, with all its profit orientation, taking the renewable resources and turn them into dollar, is they really want us to change overnight. And I really wish, since after 10 years and after 6 years of the passage of the Act, that we really start taking a look at these things. And I'm glad that you're sitting down here and talking about this, and I'm glad at least to get to talk about it, because I still work with a lot of the students that I work with. I teach Natural Science of Alaska, even though I don't have a degree, but I talk about these issues, AFN, subsistence law, the way of life, and also to compare the two between the Western culture and our culture. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Dan Gross, did you want to say anything at this point?
I can pass if you are pressed for time.
Well, not exactly pressed, so we'll treat you as perhaps the last on this subject, and then we'll turn to the Whaling Commission.
Okay, my comments are addressed to a broad issue, perhaps one of these deep thoughts that you referred to, but I hope that they'll be helpful. I want to remind you that they're based on experience in a context very different from the one which we've been discussing for the last day and a half, because all of my experience has been with dealing with the subsistence regimes among native peoples in the tropics of South America. Nevertheless, there are some issues that I've confronted in my work there, which I think may have some relevance for the questions we're addressing here. Most of the contributions that we heard from various parties referred to the integral nature of subsistence and the culture of the people who practiced subsistence economies. We see that there's a kind of triangle which includes at one pole or in at one angle subsistence activities, at another angle the what we may call the moral economy of a population which depends on subsistence, which involves reciprocal exchange and other kinds of exchanges which are mandated by the nature of the goods which are being circulated, mandated by their perishability and by the fact that the supply that is available is not constant for any household or any individual. And these exchanges then become traditional and customary and are may even be regarded in some ways as sacred. The third pole or the third angle of the triangle is village life, which is founded on and based very heavily on this moral economy, the exchange of goods, and on the subsistence activities in which people engaged. The size of the village, the location of the village, I believe that it's true certainly in the context of Alaskan natives, just as it is in other areas of subsistence economy, that the size and location of village is very much dependent on these other aspects. Now, and on these on this triangle or triumvirate of factors, the persistence of native culture rests and the identity of native peoples. This is the way I see it from the experiences I've had in another part of the world. The aspect that I believe hasn't received quite as much emphasis in most of the discussions here has been that these factors and the relationship between these factors are not frozen in time. There is good evidence in the cases that I have knowledge of, once again from another part of the world, that change was going on constantly, even before contact with Europeans, that these groups were not simply arrested at a particular stage of development. Change was probably accelerated after European contact and after the introduction of new technologies, new diseases, and after people were pushed off the land and moved to areas where their subsistence habits had to change. The point of all of this deep thinking is that the context in which any particular native community exists is a dynamic one. It's a changing one. The danger is, I think, for some of these communities to allow at any moment for outsiders to determine what is customary and traditional within those contexts, and to suggest to them that this is what it is to be an Alaska Native, that it is customary and traditional to use this kind of weapon or this mode of transportation, or it is customary and traditional for people to live in a village of a certain size. If they live in a village of a larger size, that it is not appropriate for them to be subsistence producers. I was intrigued by a lot of the discussion that I heard, particularly today, but also yesterday, which gives me reason to believe that the culture of Alaska Natives is as it is elsewhere, very dynamic and constantly changing. And it is, in the case of all living cultures, a culture which is constantly redefining itself and constantly engaged in a negotiation with other cultures as to what its own identity is and how it's going to make its way. So I think that the relevance now, the practical aspect of this, has to do with the way in which the rights of access to subsistence resources are going to be defined. If they are going to be defined in terms of some of the formulations that we've heard, I think there is a danger that the possibility for dynamic change, for adaptive change in the future, will be closed off. And if, on the other hand, they can be defined in a way which is appropriate to the particular cultures involved, and with their participation of the people of these groups, I think there is a greater chance that these changes, that these cultures will be able to continue to adapt and to continue to pursue subsistence economies, not in the same way as they have in the past. I think that's out of the question, but with a substantial amount of dependence on those resources.
Rosita?
Yes, Your Honor. Just for the record, I would like to expand on the translation that my grandfather, Austin Hammond, gave to you in the prepared statement you have there. He wishes that BLM were here. He asks, are there any BLM officials here, because he wanted to tell the story of how the Hlukalkhadi clan claims title to the Chilkoot Lake and River area. And he then, you know, goes on to tell the story, and you have a brief account of how the Hlukalkhadi came to claim and gain title of that area. And when he found out that the federal government and that the state had title to the land, he then asks them, and he wanted to again ask BLM, okay, if you have title to the land, you tell me the stories. You tell me the stories which give you and validate your claim to that area. And he suspects that they don't have any stories. Right. And the other issue that he wishes to raise is that the laws have given title to other people, to to other people besides the Hlukalkhadi. They've given them title to the land. And he says the state, he equates the arrival of white people like a tidal wave. And this is a story we've heard over and over again, that white people are like a tidal wave. They are coming in and pounding on your shores. And they take title to your land and implement laws and regulations that affect their way of life. And he sees this the tidal wave as continuing. He has a charge to protect his land for his grandchildren, and he feels remiss in the fact that he has not been able to achieve title to the Chilkoot Lake and Chilkoot River area, or any of the area. As a matter of fact, they have no title to under ANCSA. The Chilkoot people did not receive 1 acre of land, and he feels that he's not, you know, been able to succeed in his duty to protect the land for his children. And he talks also a little bit about the relationship that the Hlukalkhadi have to the wildlife. And he talks about how, you know, the spiritual relationship that they have, that they care for them so much that they will even clean the rocks on the river, so as the sockeye won't get entangled, you know, they won't get entangled in the seaweed. And yesterday you heard, you know, how unhappy he was with the fish weir, and he feels that the fish weir is responsible for decreasing the population. He thinks that there should be a greater escapement allowed into the Chilkoot Lake area. He thinks that the river, the lake, could hold a lot more salmon, but he thinks that the fish and game don't know what they're talking about. And anyway, he again tells the story to validate his claim to the area, even though he says other people have title to it.
Thank you. We will have a complete translation of Mr. Hammond's remarks given in Tlingit when the transcript comes out. Well, I think now we can turn to specific initiatives taken by Native people in the subsistence area, and start with the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission. And Mr. Rexford and Ms. Adams, if you would.
Yes, I would like to introduce the Vice Chairman of the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, Burton Rexford. He is the commissioner in the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission from the village of Barrow.
Thank you. We're talking about subsistence, and the area I'm going to cover is whaling. Subsistence whaling has been a controversial issue locally, statewide, and nationally. In spite of the Native people's knowledge of the great bowhead whale, the Eskimos have been repeatedly put on a chopping block by the world scientists and regulatory government agencies. 99% of these people have very little knowledge of migration and behavior patterns of this great sea mammal that is so respected, and that is such a large part of our subsistence lifestyle in every way. A whaling captain is faced with great responsibilities. His number one priority is, of course, the immediate concerns of safety while out on the hazardous and icy Arctic waters. Moreover, he is concerned with the sustenance of his people. It is his knowledge and preparation that the people depend upon for their daily food. A whaling captain is also charged with the preservation of the great bowhead whale. This duty and responsibility of preservation of the whale has been handed down from time immemorial. Now, at this time, I feel that for the native people across the state of Alaska to be given the responsibilities and duties of regulating their own subsistence needs in their prospective area regions. A little bit of history of one of the captains, whaling captains from Barrow. His name is Alfred Levitt. Alfred Levitt goes on to say, was asked to discuss our cultural whaling lifestyle and the changes he has seen regarding whaling. I started whaling by first observing the whalers and by learning from them beginning in 1930. Through actual experience by the sea, I observed the older whalers' traditions. I actually started my own whaling crew in 1946 or 47. My desire for starting my own whaling crew was based on knowledge that I had gained by watching the patterns of the whales and the art of whaling from the whalers. Even though I thought I knew as much as I needed, when I caught my first whale, someone told me, when you catch your whale and there are people who helped you, and you have to give and share your whale with them without being possessive. In fact, you must give them enough that they will not have any need to ask you for some more. Yeah. This was one piece of advice that was given to me when I caught my first whale. From that time on, I learned that whaling was a very difficult task. There were occasions when we had absolutely no meat or food, and there were times that we had only two or three bombs on hand to take with us when we went out whaling. Even then, we were never uncertain, because we realized that our only obstacles to being successful were our own selves. After 1950, I did not do actual whaling for approximately 3 years and had my brothers take care of my whaling responsibility using my boat. I left the whaling in their hands. After the 3 years, I started whaling intensely and continue to do so to the present day. When I was whaling, I experienced times of hunger along with my brothers. This is when all my brothers were still alive in our lives. When we caught a whale, we actually were enriched because we knew then that we would be able to survive through the coming winter. If a village did not catch a whale, then we knew beyond the shadow of the doubt that we would experience extreme hardship and feared the oncoming hunger that would strike us. Thus, we would all be in an anticipatory mood while out whaling, even to the point of going without sleep for long periods. We knew that when we caught a whale, we would then be able to sleep easily and eat well. As for the present day, we have been given a system of quotas. Everyone seems to believe that life is much easier to live through. But when the quota system was incorporated and the censoring of the whale hunt was forced on us, it was and is the most incomprehensible difficulty we have yet endured. When we do not catch a whale, we are without our sustenance for the oncoming winter and go hungry. This is what we have to live with today. We, the Inupiat people, by our own hands, did not cause the whale population to become depleted. The Westerner told us that the whale's population was decreasing. We have not seen their numbers decrease. However, if their numbers are smaller, it is because of the Westerners' influence here in the Arctic. Our animals from ancient times have never greatly decreased in number, even though we totally subsisted on them. Even during the times we would catch 16, 20 whales in barrel, their numbers would not decrease, and still it is said that we are the cause of the depletion. The Inupiat people have unjustly been blamed for killing of the whale as a species. Without doubt, the oil companies are like this. He's attacking the industry. The oil companies know that their pollution, both noise and chemical pollution, can poison the animals of the sea. Yet we are blamed. The Inupiat people know that we do not carelessly cause depletion of the animals. Long ago, we totally subsisted on the animals and the land. Then the sea and the land were the store for us. This was the way we survived. In this day and age, we are not totally dependent on all the animals and have decreased our use of wildlife as our food source. We can now go to the stores for substitution. Keep in mind, this statement refers to barrel. We also need to keep in mind that barrel has grown in population before a balance needs to be kept with the population of barrel and the number of whales that are caught. We need to increase our quota to lessen the shortage of whale meat of the populace of barrel. We know that we have no control over the Arctic animals, but Westerners do have that controlling factor. It being the oil exploration and environmental changes that happen, poisonous substances produced by the oil companies have been known to kill caribou, polar bears, and fish. Whenever we kill an animal, we utilize all of it. Even if something negative happens, even if the meat is rancid, we still eat all the whale meat. I was happy to be able to talk about these issues when the opportunity was presented to me. I had a grandfather named Akawak, who then I was growing up used to talk to me and tell me this: if you are ever lazy, you will have hunger. Excuse me. I would ponder what my grandfather had said when I started hunting. I seriously contemplated that statement and took my whaling responsibilities with solemnity. My grandfather also used to say to me, if you are going to hunt animals, you have to be absolutely still within yourself. We are not the caretakers of the animals. Only the universe is. And as for the future of the sea waters, any action by the oil companies must be made with extreme caution because of the very large number of sea and land animals, not to mention people, that depend upon the sea for their livelihood. I want to be able to hunt the bowhead whale and barrel for as long as I can. I will cite a story narrated to me. My grandfather would talk about, I'm having trouble with Eskimo words here.
Tukak.
Anaruk. Who were brothers. Anaruk was an able whaler, but Tukak was the more skillful whaler. Thus, their mother would physically tire from feeding so many people through the winter months to keep them from going hungry. Even though each of the men had wives, these stories were heard when I was growing up. I also used to hear stories about the people from Nuvuk, Point Barrow, who would tease each other by creating teasing songs. I will now sing the song that Anaruk made for his brother. My mother,
Kulachaluk,
did not have a very able hunter on her hands, who is Anaruk, but I do have a brother who is Tukak, and indeed he is a man. Ever since that time I was able to remember, there was an unwritten law that the whalers could not take another person's belongings. But times have changed within the present day living whaling conditions. We seriously have to unite together and help each other out without being opponents to one another, because living conditions are constantly changing. My grandfather would tell me that if a person did not want to be helpful, then he was respected enough to be left alone. This was within the whaling circles. These are some of the things that my father would discuss with me. He further reiterated not to bother people who oppose you, but that if I like an animal, then I had to give it to the people. This was his lecture to me concerning whaling and what he had observed firsthand as a whaler. I also observed what he had relayed to me while I was whale hunting. My grandfather never worked for me in any way except by the words of wisdom, of which he passed on to me. It was indeed, and still is to a large degree, difficult to whale hunt. I have undergone periods of time when we did not have any heating equipment to keep us warm, nor food for sustenance. There was a time I remember well when I was whaling with Takpak, along with Akachek. We were able-bodied young men at that time, and Takpak would occasionally admonish us to go ashore and get something to eat. This was during the time that all we had in our whaling camp were weaponry. We were given a small cup of tea infrequently. Yes, those were the hard times we experienced when whaling. Finally, the time came when Akevak took us out to hunt for seals. Since we did not even have scraps of food to eat, along the way we met the Akuchuk hunters. They encouraged us to go ashore to get something to eat. So we did eat till we were full. Afterwards, we headed back out to hunt for seals. We did finally find one.